This is a reading of A Philosophy of Freedom by Rudolf Steiner, entitled in this edition, Intuitive Thinking as a Spiritual Path. This is part one. I'm beginning with a preface to the revised edition of 1918. Everything discussed in this book is organized around two root questions of the human soul. First, can we understand human nature in such a way that this understanding serves as the basis for everything else we may meet in the way of experience or science? Parenthesis, for we have the sense that what we meet in this way cannot sustain itself, because doubt and critical thinking can drive it into the realm of uncertainty. Parenthesis. Second, can we human beings as willing entities ascribe freedom to ourselves? Or is this freedom a mere illusion that arises because we do not see the threads of necessity upon which our willing, like any other natural event, depends? This is no artificial question. It proceeds naturally from a certain mood of soul. We even feel that the soul would be less than it should be if it never earnestly came face to face with these two possibilities, freedom or necessity of the will. The purpose of this book is to show that our inner experiences of the second question depend upon how we view the first. I try to present a view of the human being that can support all other knowledge. I also attempt to show how this view fully justifies the idea of freedom of the will, provided that one finds the region of the soul where free will can develop. Once achieved, this view can become part of the very life of the soul itself. But no theoretical answer is given that once acquired is simply carried as a conviction preserved by memory. Such an answer would have to be an illusion, according to the style of thought underlying this book. Therefore, no such finished, closed-off answer is provided here. Rather, reference is made to a region of soul experience in which, through the soul's inner activity, the question answers itself in a living way, always anew, whenever a human being needs it. Once we have found the region of the soul where these questions unfold, really perceiving this region gives us all that we need to answer these riddles of life. Thereafter, we can journey further through the depths and breadths of this life of riddles as need and fate provide. Indeed, with this region of soul experience, we seem to have located an insight that finds justification and validity through its own life and through the relationship of this life to the whole life of the human soul. This is how I thought about the content of this book when I wrote it out 25 years ago. Today, as well, I must characterize the book's key thoughts in the same way. At that time, I limited myself to saying no more than is connected in the strictest sense to the two root questions described above. If anyone is surprised to find nothing here about the world of spiritual experience described in my later writings, it should be borne in mind that I did not want at that time to discuss the results of spiritual research. Rather, my purpose was first to lay the foundations on which such results can rest. This, quote, philosophy of freedom, unquote, does not contain specific results of that kind, any more than it contains specific results from natural science. But what it does contain will be indispensable, in my opinion, to anyone striving for certainty in such knowledge. What the book says might also be acceptable to many who, for whatever reasons of their own, want nothing to do with the results of spiritual scientific research. Those who are drawn to these results may also find significant my attempt to demonstrate how an unprejudiced consideration of simply the two questions characterized above, which are fundamental for all cognition, leads to the view that human beings live within an actual spiritual world. In this book, I try to validate cognition of the spiritual realm before one enters spiritual experience. Hence, there is no need to cast furtive glances toward the experiences that I put forward later on, as long as one is able or willing to enter into the style of the discussion itself. Thus, this book seems to me quite separate from my actual spiritual scientific writings. On the other hand, it also seems to be connected with them in the most intimate way, so that now, after 25 years, I can republish the text essentially unaltered. I have, however, made additions of some length to a number of chapters. Misinterpretations of what I had said made such extensive additions seem necessary. The only passages I have rewritten are those in which a quarter century ago I expressed myself poorly. Only people of ill will would take these changes as proof that I changed my fundamental conviction. The book has now been out of print for many years. I feel that the same things need to be said today as 25 years ago. Nevertheless, I hesitated long over the completion of this new edition. I asked myself again and again whether I ought, in this or that passage, to confront the numerous philosophical views that have come to light since the appearance of the first edition. In recent years, involvement in purely spiritual scientific researches prevented me from doing this in the way I would wish. Yet I have convinced myself, after the most thorough survey I could make of current philosophical work, that such discussion does not belong here, tempting as it might be in itself. What seemed necessary to say about the latest philosophical tendencies from the point of view taken in intuitive thinking as a spiritual path, a philosophy of freedom, can be found in the second volume of my Riddles of Philosophy. End of the preface. Part 1. Theory. The Knowledge of Freedom. Chapter 1. Conscious Human Action. Is a human being spiritually free, or subject to the iron necessity of purely natural law? Few questions have excited so much ingenuity. The idea of the freedom of human will has found both sanguine supporters and stiff-necked opponents in plenty. There are those who, in their moral zeal, cast aspersions on the intellect of anyone who can deny so obvious a fact as freedom. They are opposed by others, who see the acme of unscientific thinking in the belief that the lawfulness of nature fails to apply to the area of human action and thinking. One and the same thing is explained equally often as the most precious possession of humankind and as its worst illusion. Infinite subtlety has been expended to explain how human freedom is consistent with the workings of nature, of which, after all, human beings are also a part. No less effort has gone into the attempt from the other side to explain how such a delusion could ever have arisen. All but the most superficial thinkers feel that we have to do here with one of the most important questions of life, religion, conduct, and science. And it is among the sad signs of the superficiality of contemporary thinking that a book intending to coin a, quote, new belief, unquote, from the results of recent scientific research, David Friedrich Strauss's The Old and New Belief, contains nothing on this question but the words, quote, "We need not here go into the question of the freedom of human will. The supposed freedom of indifferent choice has been recognized as an empty phantom by every philosophy worthy of the name, while the moral valuation of human conduct and character remains untouched by the question." Unquote. I cite this passage not because I think the book from which it derives has any special significance, but because it seems to me to express the opinion which the majority of our thinking contemporaries have been able to achieve on this question. Today, everyone who can claim to have outgrown scientific kindergarten appears to know that freedom cannot consist in choosing arbitrarily between two possible actions. There is always, so it is claimed, a quite specific reason why a person performs one specific action from among several possibilities. This seems obvious. Nevertheless, present-day opponents of freedom direct their principal attacks only against freedom of choice. After all, Herbert Spencer, whose views daily gain wider acceptance, says, quote, "that anyone could desire or not desire arbitrarily, which is the real proposition concealed in the dogma of free will, is refuted as much through the analysis of consciousness as through the content of the preceding chapter on psychology." End of, end quote. Others also proceed from the same point of view when they combat the concept of free will. Their arguments can all be found in germinal form as early as Spinoza. What he presented with clarity and simplicity against the idea of freedom has since been repeated countless times, only generally sheathed in the most sophistic theoretical doctrines, so that it becomes difficult to recognize the simple course of thought on which everything depends. In a letter of October or November 1674, Spinoza writes, quote, "Thus I call a thing free that exists and acts out of the pure necessity of its nature, and I call it compelled if its existence and activity are determined in a precise and fixed manner by something else. Thus God, for example, though necessary, is free, because he exists only out of the necessity of his nature. Similarly, God knows himself and everything else freely, because it follows from the necessity of his nature alone that he should know everything. You see, then, that I locate freedom not in free decision, but in free necessity. Let us, however, descend to created things, which are all determined to exist and to act in fixed and precise ways by outside causes. To see this more clearly, let us imagine a very simple case. A stone, for example, receives a certain momentum from an external cause that comes into contact with it, so that later, when the impact of the external cause has ceased, it necessarily continues to move. This persistence of the stone is compelled and not necessary, because it had to be established by the impact of an external cause. What applies here to the stone applies to everything else, no matter how complex and multifaceted. Everything is necessarily determined by an outside cause to exist and to act in a fixed and precise manner. Now, please assume that the stone, as it moves, thinks and knows that it is trying as much as it can to continue in motion. This stone, which is only conscious of its effort and by no means indifferent, will believe that it is quite free, and that it continues in its motion not because of an external cause, but only because it wills to do so. But this is that human freedom that all claim to possess, and that only consists in people being aware of their desires, but not knowing the causes by which they are determined. Thus, the child believes that it freely desires the milk, the angry boy that he freely demands revenge, and the coward flight. Again, drunkards believe it is a free decision to say what, when sober again, they will wish that they had not said. And since this prejudice is inborn in all humans, it is not easy to free oneself from it. For although experience teaches us sufficiently that people are least able to moderate their desires, and that moved by contradictory passions, they see what is better and do what is worse, yet they still consider themselves free. And this, because they desire some things less intensely, and because some desires can be easily inhibited through the recollection of something else that is familiar." End quote. Because this view is expressed clearly and definitely, it is easy to discover the fundamental error in it. Just as a stone necessarily carries out a specific movement in response to an impact, human beings are supposed to carry out an action by a similar necessity if impelled to it by any reason. Human beings imagine themselves to be the free originators of their actions only because they are aware of these actions. In so doing, however, they overlook the causes driving them, which they must obey unerringly. The error in this train of thought is easy to find. Spinoza and all who think like him overlook the human capacity to be aware not only of one's actions, but also of the causes by which one's actions are guided. No one can dispute that a child is unfree when it desires milk, as is a drunkard who says things and later regrets them. Both know nothing of the causes active in the depths of their organism that exercise irresistible control over them. But is it justifiable to lump together actions of this kind with those in which humans are conscious not only of their actions, but also of the reasons that motivate them? Are the actions of human beings really all of a single kind? Should the acts of a warrior on the battlefield, a scientist in the laboratory, a diplomat involved in complex negotiations, be set scientifically on the same level as that of a child when it desires milk. It is certainly true that the solution to a problem is best sought where it is simplest, but the lack of a capacity to discriminate has often brought about endless confusion. And there is, after all, a profound difference between knowing and not knowing why I do something. This seems self-evident. Yet the opponents of freedom never ask whether a motive that I know and see through compels me in the same sense as the organic process that causes a child to cry for milk. Edward von Hartmann, in his Phenomenology of Moral Consciousness, claims that human willing depends on two main factors, motive and character. If we consider all human beings as the same, or at least see their differences as negligible, then their will appears to be determined from without, namely by the circumstances they encounter. But if we consider that different human beings make an idea or mental picture into a motive only when their character is such that the idea in question gives rise to a desire, then human beings appear to be determined from within and not from without. But because we must ourselves make an idea that impinges from without into a motive of action in accordance with our character, we imagine that we are free, that is, independent of external motivation. But according to Edward von Hartmann, the truth is that, quote, even though we ourselves first raise ideas into motives, yet we do this not arbitrarily, but according to the necessity of our characterological organization, that is, we are anything but free, end quote. Here, too, no consideration is given to the difference between motives that I allow to affect me only after having permeated them with my consciousness and those that I follow without having a clear knowledge of them. This leads immediately to the standpoint from which the matter will be considered here. Can the question of the freedom of our will be posed narrowly by itself? And if not, with what other questions must it necessarily be linked? If there is a difference between a conscious motive and an unconscious drive, then the conscious motive will bring with it an action that must be judged differently from an action done out of blind impulse. Our first question will concern this difference. The position we must take on freedom itself will depend on the result of this inquiry. What does it mean to have knowledge of the motives of one's actions? This question has been given too little attention, because we always tear in two the inseparable whole that is the human being. We distinguish between the doer and the knower, but we have nothing to say about one who matters most, the one who acts out of knowledge. People say that human beings are free when they obey reason alone and not animal desires. Or they say that freedom means being able to determine one's life and actions according to purposes and decisions. Nothing is gained by such claims, for the question is precisely whether reason, purposes, and decisions exercise control over human beings in the same way as animal desires. If a reasonable decision arises in me of itself with the same necessity as hunger and thirst, then I can but obey its compulsion, and my freedom is an illusion. Another turn of phrase puts it thus. To be free does not mean being able to will whatever one wills, but being able to do what one wills. In his Atomistics of the Will, the poet-philosopher Robert Hemmerling expresses this idea incisively, quote, human beings can certainly do what they will, but they cannot will what they will, since their willing is determined by motives. They cannot will what they will. Let us look at these words more closely. Do they contain any reasonable meaning? Must freedom of the will, then, consist in being able to will something without having grounds, without a motive? But what does willing mean other than having grounds to do or attempt this rather than that? To will something without grounds, without motive, would mean willing something without willing it. The concept of motivation is inseparably linked to the concept of the will. Without a determining motive, the will is an empty capacity. It only becomes active and real through the motive. Thus it is quite correct that the human will is not free, inasmuch as its direction is always determined by the strongest motive. But it is absurd, in contrast to this unfreedom, to speak of a conceivable freedom of the will that involves being able to will what one does not will. End quote. Even here, only motives in general are discussed, without considering the difference between conscious and unconscious motives. If a motive acts upon me, and I am forced to follow it because it proves to be the strongest of its kind, then the thought of freedom ceases to have any meaning. Why should it matter to me whether I can do something or not if I am forced by the motive to do it? The first question is not whether I can or cannot do something once the motive has operated upon me, but whether there exists only motives of the kind that operate with compelling necessity. If I have to will something, then I may even be utterly indifferent as to whether I can actually do it. If, because of my character and the circumstances prevailing in my environment, a motive were forced upon me that my thinking showed me was unreasonable, then I would even have to be glad if I could not do what I will. It is not a question of whether I can execute a decision once it is made, but of how the decision arises within me. What distinguishes humans from all other organic beings rests on rational thinking, activity we have in common with other organisms. Seeking analogies for human action in the animal kingdom does not help to clarify the concept of freedom. Modern natural science loves such analogies. And when science succeeds in finding among animals something similar to human action, it believes it has touched on the most important question of the science of humanity. Paul Ray's book, The Illusion of Free Will, offers one example of the misunderstandings to which this opinion leads. On page 5, Ray states with regard to freedom, quote, "It is easy to explain why it appears to us as if the movement of the stone is necessary while the donkey's will is not. The causes that move the stone are, after all, external and visible, but the causes by which the donkey desires are internal and invisible. Between us and the site of their activity, there lies the donkey's skull. One does not see the causal determination, and therefore imagines that it is not present. The will, we say, while it is the cause of the donkey's turning around, is itself undetermined. It is an absolute beginning." End quote. Here, too, is an utter disregard for human actions in which the human being has an awareness of the reasons for the action. For Ray explains, quote, "Between us and the site of their activity, there lies the donkey's skull." Unquote. We can see from these words alone that Ray has no inkling that there exist actions, not a donkey's, but a human's, for which there lies, between us and the action, the motive that has become conscious. He proves this again a few pages later when he says, quote, "We are not aware of the causes by which our will is determined, and so we imagine that it is not causally determined at all." Unquote. But enough of examples proving that many fight against freedom without at all knowing what freedom is. Obviously, my action cannot be free if I, as the actor, do not know why I carry it out. But what about an action for which the reasons are known? This leads us to ask, what is the origin and the significance of thinking? For without understanding the soul's activity of thinking, no concept of the knowledge of anything, including an action, is possible. When we understand what thinking means in general, it will be easy to clarify the role that thinking plays in human action. As Hegel rightly says, quote, "Thinking turns the soul, with which beasts too are gifted, into spirit." Unquote. Therefore, thinking will also give to human action its characteristic stamp. This is by no means to claim that all our actions flow only from the sober deliberations of our reason. I am far from calling human, in the highest sense, only those actions that proceed from abstract judgment alone. But as soon as our actions lift themselves above the satisfaction of purely animal desires, our motives are always permeated by thoughts. Love, pity, patriotism are springs of action that cannot be reduced to cold, rational concepts. People say that the heart, the sensibility, comes into its own in such matters. No doubt. But heart and sensibility do not create the motives of action. They presuppose them, and then receive them into their own realm. Pity appears in my heart when the mental image of a person who arouses pity in me enters my consciousness. The way to the heart goes through the head. Love is no exception here. If it is not a mere expression of the sexual drive, then love is based on mental pictures that we form of the beloved. And the more idealistic these mental pictures are, the more blessed is the love. Here, too, thought is the father of feeling. People say that love makes us blind to the beloved's flaws. But we can also turn this around and claim that love opens our eyes to the beloved's strengths. Many pass by these good qualities without noticing them. One person sees them, and just for this reason, love awakens in the soul. What else has this person done but make a mental picture what 100 others have ignored? Love is not theirs because they lack. Love is not theirs because they lack the mental picture. We can approach the matter however we like. It only grows clearer that the question regarding the nature of human actions presupposes another, that of the origin of thinking. I shall, therefore, turn to this question next. Chapter 2, The Fundamental Urge for Knowledge. A quote from Goethe. Two souls, alas, dwell within my breast. Each wants to separate from the other. One in hearty love-lust clings to earth with clutching organs. The other lifts itself mightily from the dust to high ancestral regions. Goethe, Faust, Part 1. End quote. With these words, Goethe characterizes a trait deeply based in human nature. As human beings, we are not organized in a fully integrated, unified way. We always demand more than the world freely offers. Nature gives us needs, and the satisfaction of some of these she leaves to our own activity. The gifts allotted to us are abundant, but even more abundant is our desire. We seem born for dissatisfaction. The urge to know is only a special case of this dissatisfaction. We look at a tree twice. The first time we see its branches at rest, the second time in motion. We are unsatisfied with this observation. Why, we ask, does the tree present itself to us now at rest, now at motion, now in motion? Every glance at nature engenders a host of questions within us. We receive a new problem with each phenomenon that greets us. Every experience becomes a riddle. We see a creature similar to the mother animal emerging from the egg, and we ask the reason for this similarity. We observe a living creature's growth and development to a certain degree of perfection, and we seek the conditions of this experience. Nowhere are we content with what nature displays before our senses. We look everywhere for what we call an explanation of the facts. That which we seek in things, over and above what is given to us immediately, splits our entire being into two parts. We become aware of standing in opposition to the world as independent beings. The universe appears to us as two opposites, I and world. We set up this barrier between ourselves and the world as soon as consciousness lights up within us. But we never lose the feeling that we do belong to the world, that a link exists that connects us to it, that we are creatures not outside but within the universe. This feeling engenders an effort to bridge the opposition. And in the final analysis, the whole spiritual striving of humankind consists in bridging this opposition. The history of spiritual life is a continualist searching for the unity between the I and the world. Religion, art, and science share this as their goal. The religious believer seeks the solution to the world riddle posed by the I, capital, which is unsatisfied by the merely phenomenal world, in the revelation meted out by God. Artists try to incorporate the ideas of their I in various materials to reconcile what lives within them to the outer world. They too feel unsatisfied with the merely phenomenal world and seek to build into it the something more that their I, going above and beyond the world of phenomena, contains. Thinkers seek the laws of phenomena, striving to penetrate in thinking what they experience through observation. Only when we have made the world content into our thought content do we rediscover the connection from which we have sundered ourselves. We shall see later that this goal is reached only when the tasks of scientific research are understood much more profoundly than often occurs. The whole relation between the I and the world that I have portrayed here meets us on the stage of history, in the contrast between a unitary worldview, or monism, and a two-world theory, or dualism. Dualism directs its gaze solely to the separation that human consciousness effects between the I and the world. Its whole effort is a futile struggle to reconcile these opposites, which it may call spirit and matter, subject and object, or thinking and phenomenon. It feels that a bridge between the two worlds must exist, but it is incapable of finding it. When human beings experience themselves as I, they can do no other than think of this I as being on the side of spirit. When to this I then oppose the world, they ascribe to the latter. Let me read that again. When to this I they then oppose the world, they ascribe to the latter the perceptual world given to the senses, the material world. In this way, human beings locate themselves within the opposition of spirit and matter. They do so all the more because their own bodies belong to the material world. The I thus belongs to the spiritual as a part of it, while material things and processes, which are perceived by the senses, belong to the world. All the riddles, therefore, that have to do with spirit and matter must be rediscovered by human beings in the fundamental riddle of their own essential being. Monism directs its gaze exclusively to unity and seeks to deny or erase the opposites, present though these are. Neither monism nor dualism is satisfactory, for neither does justice to the facts. Dualism sees spirit, I, and matter, world, as two fundamentally different entities, and therefore it cannot understand how the two can affect one another. How could spirit know what is going on in matter, if matter's specific nature is altogether foreign to spirit? Or, given these conditions, how could spirit affect matter so that intentions translate into deeds? The most ingenious and absurd hypotheses have been proposed to answer these questions. Yet to the present day, things are hardly better with monism, which until now has attempted three solutions. Either it denies spirit and becomes materialism, or it denies matter, seeking salvation through spiritualism, or else it claims that matter and spirit are inseparably united, even in the simplest entity, so that it should come as no surprise if these two forms of existence, which after all are never apart, appear together in human beings. Materialism can never offer a satisfactory explanation of the world, for every attempt at an explanation must begin with one's forming thoughts about phenomena. Thus, materialism starts with the thought of matter or of material processes. In so doing, it already has two different kinds of facts on hand, the material world and thoughts about it. Materialism attempts to understand the latter by seeing them as a purely material process. It believes that thinking occurs in the brain in the same way as digestion occurs in the animal organism. Just as it ascribes mechanical and organic effects to matter, Materialism also assigns to matter the capacity, under certain circumstances, to think. But it forgets that all it has done is to shift the problem to another location. Materialists ascribe the capacity to think to matter rather than to themselves. And this brings them back to the starting point. How does matter manage to think about its own existence? Why does it not simply go on existing, perfectly content with itself? Materialism turns aside from the specific subject, our own I, and arrives at an unspecific, hazy configuration, matter. Here the same riddle comes up again. The materialist view can only displace the problem, not solve it. And what of the spiritualist view? Pure spiritualists deny matter any independent existence and conceive of it only as a product of spirit. If they apply this view to the riddle of their own human existence, they are driven into a corner. Over against the I, which may be placed on the side of spirit, there suddenly appears the sensory world. No spiritual point of view into it seems open. It has to be perceived and experienced by the I through material processes. As long as it tries to explain itself solely as a spiritual entity, the I cannot find such material processes within itself. What it works out for itself spiritually never contains the sense world. It is as if the I has to admit that the world remains closed to it, unless it puts itself into an unspiritual relationship to the world. Similarly, when we decide to act, we must translate our intentions into reality with the help of material stuff and forces. We are thus referred back to the outer world. The most extreme spiritualist, or perhaps the thinker who, through his absolute idealism, presents himself as an extreme spiritualist, is Johann Gottlieb Fichte. Fichte attempted to derive the whole world structure from the I. What he, in fact, succeeded in creating was a magnificent thought picture of the world, but one without any experiential content. Just as it is impossible for the materialist to declare spirit out of existence, so the spiritualist cannot disavow the external material world. When we direct our cognition to the I, we initially perceive the activity of this I in the development of a world of ideas unfolded through thought. Because of this, those with a spiritualist worldview sometimes feel themselves tempted, in regard to their own human essence, to acknowledge nothing of the spirit except this world of ideas. In such cases, spiritualism becomes one-sided idealism. It does not arrive at the point of seeking a spiritual world through a world of ideas. It sees the spiritual world in the idea world itself. Its worldview is forced to remain fixed, as if spellbound, within the activity of the I itself. A curious variant of idealism is the view of Friedrich Albert Lange, as represented in his widely read History of Materialism. Lange takes the position that materialism is quite right when it explains all world phenomena, including our thinking, as products of purely material processes, while, conversely, matter and its processes are themselves a product of thinking. Quote, "The senses give us effects of things, not faithful pictures, let alone the things themselves. But these mere effects include the senses along with the brain and the molecular vibrations within it." Unquote. That is, our thinking is produced by material processes, and these are produced by the thinking of the I. Lange's philosophy is thus nothing but the conceptual version of the story of the brave Munchausen, who holds himself up in the air by his own pigtail. A third form of monism sees both essences, matter and spirit, as already united in the simplest entity, the atom. But here too nothing is achieved, except that the question which actually originates in our consciousness is displaced to a certain arena. If it is an indivisible unity, how does a unitary entity manage to express itself in a twofold way? In regard to all these points of view, we must emphasize that the fundamental and primal opposition confronts us first in our own consciousness. It is we who separate ourselves from the native ground of nature and place ourselves as I in opposition to the world. Goethe gives this its classical expression in his essay Nature, even if his style initially appears quite unscientific. Quote, "We live in her, nature's, midst, and are strangers to her. She speaks with us continually, yet does not betray her secret to us." Unquote. But Goethe also knows the reverse aspect. Quote, "All humans are within her, and she in them." Unquote. It is true that we have estranged ourselves from nature, but it is just as true that we feel we are in her and belong to her. It can only be her activity that lives in us. We must find the way back to her again. A simple reflection can show us the way. To be sure, we have torn ourselves away from nature, but we must still have taken something with us into our own being. We must seek out this natural being within ourselves, and then we shall also rediscover the connection to her. Dualism fails to do this. It considers the inner human as a spiritual being, quite foreign to nature, and then seeks to attach this being to nature. No wonder that it cannot find the connecting link. We can only find nature outside us if we first know her within us. What is akin to her within us will be our guide. Our way is thus mapped out for us. We do not wish to speculate about the interaction of nature and spirit. We wish to descend into the depths of our own being, to find there those elements that we have saved in our flight out of nature. The investigation of our own being must bring us the solution to the riddle. We must come to a point where we can say to ourselves, "Here I am no longer merely I. There is something here that is more than I." I am aware that some who have read to this point will not find my explanations correspond to, quote, the present state of science, unquote. I can only reply that up to now I have been concerned not with scientific results, but rather with a simple description of what we all experience in our own consciousnesses. Diverse statements about attempts to reconcile consciousness with the world also entered the stream of argument, but only to clarify the actual facts. For this reason, too, I attach no value to using the individual expressions such as I, spirit, world, nature, and so forth in the precise way that is usual in psychology and philosophy. Everyday consciousness is unfamiliar with the sharp distinctions of science, and up to this point my intention has been to survey the facts of everyday life. What concerns me is not how science, until now, has interpreted consciousness, but rather how consciousness experiences itself hour by hour. This is the end of the first recorded part. I will begin the second part with Chapter 3, Thinking in the Service of Understanding the World, which is on page 27 of the Centennial Edition of Intuitive Thinking as a Spiritual Path by Rudolf Steiner.